Another team that I waited quite a long time to do because I wanted to see how Dante Exum looks this preseason is the Utah Jazz. And joining me is the godfather of NBA daily podcasting, Utah Jazz radio broadcast voice, and also the creator of the prolific Locked On Sports Network. David Locke, how are you?
I'm good. It's the Locked On Podcast Network, but I will forgive you for that. That's okay. only inspired by the daily podcasting of Dunked On Basketball. So I think we're all fighting the same fight against the same big, huge monsters. And so I admire what you've done. And it was probably part of the inspiration for building the Locked On Podcast Network this summer.
Yeah. Let's not complain about those monsters too much. I actually just wrote, I'm writing some insider profiles for them now. Kevin Pelton comes on our shows whenever we ask him to. I don't hate the monsters that much.
I don't hate the monsters, but we're trying to compete with them. And they're, you know, I'm not saying, you know, we're all in the same realm and they're big. So I'm proud of what you've been able to accomplish in that realm, and I think it gives a lot of us confidence in what we're doing.
Yeah, I only have 59 other podcasts that I need to start to catch up to you, or 60, I guess, if you count Locked On NBA. But
we might actually be up to 66. I think because we have the fantasy shows on each, we have the national shows on each, and then we have the 62 team shows, and we have the NFL draft show, and then there's the question of whether or not we're going to launch a daily NBA draft show.
Wow, that would be hardcore. And I do think, actually, I mean, I don't know like what people listen to as far as college basketball podcasts, like what's out there. I don't really encounter that many, but that might be an underserved market.
Well, that's being talked about as well. Locked On College Basketball is being bantied about, and if it's done, the host is a really it's a really exciting host if we do it.
Yeah, all right, well, let's talk a little Utah Jazz here. I think the place to start for me, which I think is quite relevant with this team, perhaps more than any other in basketball, is just the discussion of how good they were last year. Part of the reason why I think they have such a high over under of 47.5 this year, number one, the offseason acquisitions, but number two, I mean, this team had the point differential of a 46 win team a year ago despite winning only 40.
I'm not as convinced on this point differential game as everybody else is. I know that in the stats community this is kind of a traditional, you know, way to look at it. I also feel like part of the reason that the Jazz didn't match their differential last year was frankly because of the fact that they weren't very good late in games. And too often it was that they were coming into those late in games trailing and they couldn't close it out. Some of the time was the games, if you looked back at it, which we've done, and you look back at it, you know, the issue is actually that they then went up again, you know, they lost games to Duncan and Steph Curry and Chris Paul and LeBron James and players of that sort. And so I'm not as in love with those. What I do like, and which is interesting, by the way, because I know that a lot of stats community people look at this and say there's way too much noise in it, is that if you look at the Jazz most commonly used lineups, which of course I've pulled up here to show you, and none of the NBA.com sites are working right now, so I can't give you exactly the numbers on them. But if I can be general, you look at the top four lineups the Jazz had, I think they were all plus eight or more in 100 possessions. I think if you look at the top five lineups that played 100 minutes with Gordon Hayward, they were all about plus eight, and three of them were over plus 10. If you look at the top four that played 75 minutes with Rudy Gobert when he wasn't injured, they were all plus nine or more, and one of them was plus 22. And what was wrong with this team last year was that they couldn't complete 48 minutes of lineups on a floor. And they just at times had, due to injuries and just lack of depth, had lineups on the floor that were not good. And so when it got down to it, they were trailing by three or four coming into those final minutes of games, and they couldn't overcome it to win those, and they lost a tremendous amount of games. I believe it was 25 games in which they lost in the that were within five in the last 5 minutes of a game. So, you know, that's an awful lot. I feel like last year's record was representative of who that team was. I didn't think they were that much better than that. I know that the point differential says that, but I guess I'm not buying into that completely.
Fair enough. I think, but for projection purposes, I think you look at some of the deeper bench guys that they were forced to play last year, the fact that they did not have an NBA quality starter at point guard really the whole year, but and I mean, you noticed that like Shelvin Mack, when he came in, had a 6.8 net rating, really stabilized things for them. But even that, he proved so much of an upgrade, I think, was quite telling about what they had at the position earlier. And then, you know, they just had to play guys who were probably fourth and fifth wings on a lot of teams, Joe Ingles, and then, you know, Chris Johnson and Jeff Withey was pretty decent, had to play a lot. But, you know, Trey Lyles was a rookie, just because they had so many injuries, and especially that period when both Favors and Gobert were out, it was difficult. And hopefully that won't happen that this year. And I think that's the next place I want to turn again, is these guys seem a little bit snake bit at this point in the season, both with Favors and Hayward, arguably their two best players at this point.
Well, Hayward just got his finger caught in a jersey. You know, those things happen. It may have happened. It happened to Marvin Williams the other night. It's obviously disappointing, but it does happen. And hopefully he'll be back somewhat soon. That is a snake bit. Derek Favors had the back issues last year, really worked hard this offseason to be able to get himself back into physical condition, be ready, looked incredible in early training camp as well. I mean, there was a day at training camp where he was so far and away the best player on the floor. It was crazy. Then Look was the best player on the floor in his first preseason game, and now cannot get back out on the floor with an IT band soreness. Now, I'm a little, I don't love it. I think it'd be better if you're just playing. I also, let's make sure he starts missing regular season games before you start panicking. I'm certain at this point that our organization, you know, looks at a player, and if he suddenly is having IT band soreness and it hurts a little bit this time of year, they're not going to put him out there. There's no value. What happens on Tuesday when we're in Portland will tell me a little bit more on how injured he really is.
Yeah, and I mean, aside from that back injury, which was a little concerning, I mean, I think it was just back spasms, and he ended up missing on the order of 15 games. And then obviously they probably make the playoffs if he is able to finish that game against the Warriors late in the year, because they were dominating that game when he was there, and then the Warriors were able to come back when he was out, and then he wasn't really himself for the rest of the regular year either. It is a little concerning that he has these nagging injuries. Hopefully he'll get past that, since he's a fantastic player and you'd like to see him get his due this year if the Jazz can fulfill the potential that I think they have. Anything else on the injury front that I guess the next place to start actually would be Dante Exum and how he's looked returning from that torn ACL.
Well, the other one's also Alec Burks.
Oh, right. Yeah. That's what I'm forgetting. Thank you.
Taking the floor in a 5-on-5 setting. Now, this one, I think, probably is more significant. He broke his leg last year in that horrific fall when Paul Pierce was so old that he couldn't move. So instead, he cheap shotted him on December 27th. And then he came back, but certainly didn't look right. Had what was deemed at the time pretty minor surgery on his ankle and his knee in the offseason, and has just never been able, I think, to get his body perfectly or in tuned. There's enough modern science right now that you're not rolling guys back out there when they're not quite right. And so that's, I think, preventing him from going. The next level is Dante, and Dante is where this modern science works, right? In the old days, you used to tear an ACL. Someone would, after about 4.5 months, okay, you can run, and then, all right, if you feel good, go for it. And the Jazz took the long road approach with him, and, you know, really, he tore his ACL in mid-July and didn't play a competitive game again until we opened up the preseason on October 3rd. So he was close to 15 months, and he looks like it. I mean, there hasn't been one singular moment of the preseason in which you looked at him and thought for even a second that he's a guy coming off an ACL. You might think he's inexperienced. You might think that he still has a lot of growth to have, but there hasn't been anything where he didn't look right in regards to how to play the game.
Yeah, he has looked about as good as you could expect at that time. And I do think it helps that he tore his ACL early. You know, I think if you tear it at like 21 or earlier, you know, Jabari Parker is in the same boat. He has looked pretty good after tearing his, that you're much better off than even, you know, when you're Derrick Rose's age, like 23. I think there's really just a kind of difference in the body that if you're still growing and you're still young, you can really come back from those sorts of things much more easily. So Dante has looked good physically, but what's his game going to look like this year? How can he contribute to the Jets?
You know, I still think we have to pull back a little bit very realistically and say two things about Dante. One is he's played one of the last 3 years of basketball, right? He didn't play in the year prior to the draft. He played, and then he didn't play. Second thing is, when he was playing prior to that, he was playing high school players in Australia. So his level of experience is really about as low as you can have. Then go back to his rookie year and realize that as much as he, you know, I thought played well and did a lot of things well, there was, you know, he really was one of the poorest shooting seasons ever in NBA history. And then I looked at it today, and I believe he took 3 free throws from January 7th to the end of the season. So this was not a finished product before he tore the ACL. So why we think he's going to be a finished, anyone would think he's a finished product after a year off and a torn ACL, I think is probably a bit much. But, you know, this is a guy whose effective field goal percentage, I believe, was 45% in his rookie year. That's really low. And so he's not, you know, I think you got to still let him develop and be an elite level defensive player, learn, play the field, see the floor well because he's so big. But I think he's going to be pretty limited offensively. That showed a little bit last night against Portland. He was really uncomfortable when he drove to the basket and got close to the rim.
Yeah, you know, I noted that as well, why it was so devastating for the Jazz and Exum with this injury because of his lack of experience and the fact that he really just needed to develop some confidence playing against players. I think a lot of things I've been encouraged by him in the preseason, some of the stuff that we saw when I fell in love with him in the draft process. His passing vision is just outstanding on the pick and roll. He's setting, he and Boris Diaw, I think, are really helping Rudy Gobert, who's also made some advances just in his strength and finishing around the rim, but really helping him become a threat. There were times last year when Rudy really struggled to become a threat and the Jazz struggled on offense when he was in there. So I really like that a lot. I mean, he still has the jets. His defense, as you mentioned, was such a revelation as a rookie. And I think he still got that. He had that nice strip of Jamal Crawford on the attempted game winner the other day. So I think that's looking pretty good. His set shot three-pointer is looking okay. The things that I wonder about to say, all right, is this guy going to be sort of like a good defense caretaker kind of guy, actually maybe somewhat similar to George Hill, who has joined, or is he going to be more dynamic than that, rests with, as you mentioned, his ability to finish, and then also shooting jump shots off the dribble, which I think still kind of leans to the side, doesn't get a ton of elevation on a shot, not a versatile jump shooter. So those are the things I think he really has to work on. I am not sure whether those aspects are going to come around enough for him to really be a star, but I think for sure he's going to be an effective player in this league.
Ricky Rubio, I think, is an interesting model for him.
Yeah, I think he could be better than Rubio offensively, even just with his finishing and more quickness. Oh, the other thing that's a problem for him too is just he doesn't have the handle right now, I think, to play point guard when guys really get into him. That was another thing he really had to work on as a rookie and just, you know, was robbed of for that year of development time. That concerns me when guys really get into him at point guard. So he may be more effective just as kind of a wing off the bench who can defend and needs another playmaker next to him, which the Jazz fortunately have.
Yeah, I mean, when he plays point guard, if the Jazz have Rodney or Gordon or Alec or Joe or on the floor or George Hill on the floor, then that's, you know, he's just playing a wing and he can defend whomever they want him to defend. Positionally, I think the Jazz are much more conscious of things defensively than they maybe are offensively.
So let's talk about some of the new additions now. The big move, of course, was the trade of the 12th pick, which became Taurean Prince, for George Hill. What is he going to bring for the Jazz this year?
He brings everything. This is the move that I think changes who the Jazz are as a team and why you think about them differently than maybe you did a year ago. Because they have just not, their point guard since Deron Williams was, Devin Harris was okay, and then there was a Mo Williams stretch that wasn't very good. Then it was Trey Burke, who is not very good. And then last year, Trey Burke got beat out by Raul Neto, who I like a lot as a kid and a young guy. But I mean, this is still a second round draft pick that came over from Europe that hasn't started on the Brazilian national team. So, you know, while I really do like Raul a great deal and thought he did some things really well last year, it still meant that on most nights that the Utah Jazz were probably 28th, 29th, or 30th in point guards. And, you know, one scout said to me last year about the Jazz guards when it was Shelvin Mack and Raul Neto, he said to me, tell me how many teams either of your guys get any minutes on.
Yeah.
Not that they would start. For what teams do they get minutes on? And after you were done with the 76ers, it was going to get tough. I mean, at that point, the Lakers, who were not very good, were playing Clarkson and as their backup two to Russell. Well, Neto and Trey Burke and Shelvin Mack aren't getting any of those minutes. And so you started to look around and maybe a little bit at Brooklyn. I don't remember who they were playing at that point. But, you know, so the Jazz have been playing point guards who arguably would not have been in the rotation on probably 25 of the 30 teams teams in the NBA for the last few years. So now to have a guy who, sure, he's not, I don't think he's an all-star in any way, shape, or form, but I do think that he's probably 15th. Would you go with that? 15th in the NBA, right? Dead center?
No, I mean, I think he is largely underrated by, I think many in Indy were thought that Teague was a big upgrade and they're glad to see him go. But can you enumerate why it is that he's good, despite the fact that maybe, you know, he's not this like pick and roll force that you would expect out of a lot of point guards?
Well, one, he's just incredibly long. So defensively, I do think he's in the upper 10, if not upper 5 point guards, which in the Western Conference probably becomes more valuable than it was in the Eastern Conference.
And when you throw in his ability to switch too, due to that length, I mean, then you really have something.
I mean, he's 6'3 with, I think, a 6'8 wingspan, if I have
it. It might even be more than that, I think.
Yeah. And it's noticeable. It's actually one of those guys. He's one of those guys whose wingspan, when you look at him, even like last night, he's at the free throw line and Ron Boone and I were sitting courtside and Ron Boone goes, wow, look at those arms. I mean, it's really one of those things that's noticeable. The second thing I would say about him is that he's one of the better spot-up shooters in the NBA. I think he was 44% last year on open threes, which, you know, if you have Gordon Hayward and Rodney Hood making some plays, becomes a pretty nice number to have. I'll see if I can pull that up for you in a second correctly. And then, you know, the next thing when you start to dig into him a little bit more of who he is as a player is the fact that every single team he's ever played on, he's had a positive plus minus when he's on the floor. And why is that? Well, because he's completely team first, and he's one of the few guys that you can really move between both the one and the two, and he's willing to do it and doesn't have any problems with that. So for this team to add a 30-year-old with 8 years of experience who was 45% on catch and shoot threes last year, who on open threes was 45% catch shooter, that's a huge thing for them. And I think he's a game changer to who he is. And if I dug in a little bit more, as only you would on Dunked on Basketball, because you are definitely going second and third level, is if you looked at where the Jazz were, there was no scenario where the Jazz could have started this season asking Dante Exum to be the starting point guard. And frankly, having watched training camp, the George Hill trade is even better than it was at the time. And so really, the Jazz had to do something at point guard, and they could not afford to go into this season and expect to try to improve, ask Dante to be the starting point guard. Then, all right, who do you go get? Well, ideally, Dante's going to be able to play 20 to 25 minutes a night, so you need a guard who's willing to play next to him some of the time. And now, when you went on the marketplace, you only had a choice of George Hill or Drew Holiday. Those were really the only two players that matched what we're talking about here. And so to be able to go get one of them is really, really something special for Dennis Lindsay to pull off and add this guy to the team.
Yeah, and Hood or Hill even has the ability to operate a little bit more than we saw in Indiana, which he did 2 years ago. So other newcomers, Boris Diaw, they just took him into cap space basically as the Spurs were trying to clear space for Pau Gasol. I thought that Diaw really struggled last year, and not during the regular year, but during the playoffs, and he was coming off a groin injury. How's he looking in the preseason?
He looks great. I mean, maybe we just, you know, have been having our passer, you know, the Jazz bigs have been Enes Kanter, Trevor Booker, Derek Favors, Rudy Gobert. None of them are very good passers. And now you have the best passing big in the NBA, Marcus Gasol.
He's up there.
Or Diaw. I mean, I think Diaw, Marcus Gasol's really special. Diaw's more exquisite with his passing, and it's changing everyone's game to see what Boris Diaw can do passing. I'm really curious to watch what happens to the Spurs without Boris Diaw. Not that I thought his 14 or 15 minutes was that important, but he just does things on the floor that nobody else in the league does, and I didn't get it until I watched him every day at training camp. He just has a different level to him than anyone else. The other thing is, he might be the best off the court guy I've ever seen. He's so enjoyable to be around and in such a good mood. Manu Ginobili said it best. Boris Diaw's worst day is better than all of our bests. And it's true. And the thing I've noticed about the Jazz this year behind the scenes is they're together more. They're hanging around a little bit more. And it might just be as simple. Boris is the kind of guy you want to be around. Like I think of the little children's books where you've got the Pied Piper walking, right? And all the people behind him that want to be around that guy. Like, that's Boris. Like, you want to, like, oh, where's Boris? What's going on at lunch recess? Where's Boris? And you just want to be around him. He's that kind of guy. He's that enjoyable. The other night I saw him, you know, taking six guys out for dinner. And I think those are the value points on him that really could change this team, coupled the fact that he's won a championship. He's 30 some odd years old. And this team just didn't have any of that type of communication.
Joe Johnson, 2 years $22 million, another veteran voice in the locker room as well, a professional. How is he going to fit in for these guys this year?
I think Joe's going to be really interesting because when they signed him, it was before they got Boris Diaw, and my anticipation was that he was going to play a lot of four, that you would play, and that's what he did in Miami that was so very, very good. You know, what was so interesting about his game last year was that he crossed over 40,000 minutes played, and there's never been a player in this league who's been the primary offensive, successful primary offensive guy on a team after 40,000 minutes. LeBron's heading that direction. We'll see whether he can do it or whether Kyrie really starts to pick up that burden. Joe looked awful in Brooklyn last year. Then he went to Miami and played off of Dragic, played off of Wade, played off of Whiteside, looked great. I envision him, when it all comes together, playing off of Hayward, playing off of Hood. I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't close at times with Johnson, Hood, and Hayward. Maybe it is Johnson, Hood, Hayward, and Hill with whichever big, playing off favors. We haven't seen that yet in the preseason. He's played almost exclusively as the three, almost none at the four. Trey Lyles has played well as the four, so there's a minutes issue there. And Joe has not looked good in the preseason. I'm not worried about it in the sense that when I talked to Joe and I asked him about NBA in 15 years and things, he goes, you know, the only thing I don't like is the preseason and training camp. Everything else is awesome. And so I think, you know what, that's truthful. If you've been in the league for 15 years, why are you going to want to go through another training camp? And this system's different and he's trying to learn it. But I'm just not entirely sure right now exactly where he fits and how he's going to fit, partially because the Jazz have been injured in preseason, and secondarily because he hasn't played the position I thought he was going to play.
All right, I think that's probably it, at least among the newcomers who are going to. I will let you
let me ask your opinion. Your thought? I mean, I joke that I do these shows and then I'm always bummed because I listen to all of your preview shows and then I want to hear whoever your guest is that talks about the Jazz, and then I go download it and I'm like, oh, well, that's me, so that's not very much. And so I think I'm going to stop doing these shows and the Real GM show and so that I can listen to somebody else. But what's your thought on Joe Johnson and Boris Diaw? I mean, they both have crossed over 35 years old. Neither of them are their player they were at the peak, but do they match to this lineup and this roster, in your opinion?
I think they do, but more as reserves. I think that they're, you know, there's no way you can say either of them are as dynamic as Derek Favors. I still think that the Favors-Gobert pairing is the way to go, that those guys are just, you know, I understand the fit can be a little rough, but I think that those guys deserve the chance of trying to work it out, especially now with Rudy showing a bit more impetus offensively this year. I think, you know, those guys can provide something. I mean, they provide great depth, to be sure, for this team that has struggled in that area. I mean, you saw these preseason games when Hayward and Favors, arguably their two best guys, are out, and they still have more talent on the floor than the other team. And even these games when Hood is out, and Burks too. I mean, they've got all these guys out, and yet they still have like a bunch of good NBA players. So I think it'll be interesting to see. I mean, hopefully nobody is going to feel like they're squeezed for minutes, because you got to throw Trey Lyles into that as well. And even Joe Ingles, who I probably won't demand playing time, but he's a good player. He should get at least a little time on most teams. So I think you can never have too many wings, and they have a ton of versatility. And, you know, there's always a possibility either those guys could fall off a cliff at their ages, but just having more veteran presence, guys who know how to play, even down the end of games at times, if they're going to play, I think it's going to be really useful.
I mean, I agree with you. I just wonder, you're in-house and around the team all the time. You buy in a lot, and then you kind of wonder if at the end of the year you're going to be sitting there and saying to yourself, like, well, why didn't I notice that a 36-year-old, 41,000-minute Joe Johnson had lost a step? Like, I mean, you know, or that Boris Diaw didn't play last year in the playoffs. There are some signs that say that both these guys have limited left in their suitcase of basketball.
I worry about Joe at the four. I think he doesn't quite have the explosion to really. I mean, if you want to play him with a bunch of other kind of combo-y guys where you can switch, then maybe he can play at the four. I mean, like, he was a good fit next to Luol Deng last year when Deng could take on whoever was the tougher assignment out of the three and four for the other team. I think he's useful in that respect, but I think he's probably, you know, probably their fifth best option at the four just due to some of his defensive and rebound limitations.
Interesting. Trey Lyles is certainly playing well.
All right, so let's talk about who might improve on this team. I mean, another reason why I'm high on them is it's really nearly the entire roster outside of some of those old dudes that we mentioned.
Well, I think I have a general rule whenever I look at NBA players and analyze NBA teams, and that is I look at their depth chart and I highlight any player who's doing a job that he's never done before. So, for example, last year the Jazz had a bunch of these. They had Trey Lyles as a rookie, as a rotation player.
Yeah, I got to say, I don't agree with you on this one. Is there any actual statistical evidence that you're aware of that? I mean, I know you've harped on this before, and I think it may have been true with the Jazz, but you look at a team like the Blazers last year, and if you follow
but
that,
every single one of those guys, every single one of those, but no, the exact opposite. CJ McCollum was the only player on that roster that was taking a role he'd never taken before.
Aminu, Plumlee, like those guys weren't starting players before.
Aminu had started 130 games in his career.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so when he was like a rookie.
That means he's done the role before. Mo Harkless was coming off. Aminu has started 256 games in his career, 82 of them last year, but 170 of them prior. Harkless started over 100 games in Orlando in his first 2 years. So they've done that role before.
Yeah, all right. We'll agree to disagree. I would tell you on Portland,
I had the exact with that analysis, I had the exact opposite feeling on Portland than most people last year. I didn't have them at 40, whatever. I had them at about 40 though.
Yeah.
I had the only player on their entire roster that was doing a job that he had not done before was CJ McCollum. And so suddenly you looked around and realized, well, Ed Davis is totally comfortable doing this. Plumlee has started 75, 80 games in his career in the 2 years in Brooklyn before he came over to Portland. And so I wasn't surprised by them. So if you buy what I'm saying, you're welcome to not believe it. But I think that both Rodney Hood and Rudy Gobert as second year starters have a very different season this year, or have the possibility for a very different season this year than they had last year, particularly if Rudy can stay healthy. But I think they both now can go through an off-season understanding what they're about physically have to embark upon. They can go through an actual season of understanding how to get themselves through it. And I think that those two guys have a chance to have very different seasons than they had a year ago.
I will talk a little bit more about some of the improvement candidates, but first, let's do this word. So my girlfriend and I actually picked out a kitten today. We went down to the Contra Costa County Animal Shelter and picked her out. Her name is going to be Wei, which is actually from one of our favorite sci-fi novels, The Three Body Problems, one of the main characters. But anyway, she's a four-month-old black kitten, and normally I wouldn't know how much to feed a new kitten, at least not for optimal growth, but fortunately, I now have the PetNet Smart Feeder. I can just input the weight of the kitten, the type of food that we have, how often we want to feed it, and voila, the PetNet Smart Feeder will take care of the rest and feed it automatically. It gives you a notification on your phone with the PetNet app, and you can schedule and monitor all your pet's meals from your smartphone. So if you're away, you can get confirmation that it was fed. If you're not going to be home in time unexpectedly, you can just send an instruction to feed your dog or cat while you're away. So we all love our pets, and the PetNet Smart Feeder is the best way to make sure you're feeding them the right amount every day. The way you're going to get it, go to shoppetnet.com/capspace. That's shoppetnet.com/capspace. That'll get you free shipping, and more importantly, let them know that you came from us, help support the program. We've already actually gotten a couple of tweets from listeners who have ordered theirs, and with any of the products that we're gonna endorse, please send me a message on Twitter if you buy them, if you like them, or if you don't like it, any of those, please let me know. And always good to get feedback from the listeners. We want to make sure that we're recommending great products to you. So that's shoppetnet.com/capspace, shoppetnet.com/capspace. So Rudy Gobert really has been outstanding in this preseason. What has been better for him, and can that sustain into the regular year?
Multiple things fly into any improvement of this level. So one, I think Rudy is much stronger on downstairs than he was before. His lower body, his balance. Talking to him the other day, I kind of revisited the injury and asked him, you know, hey, when you planted and set your feet last year, if someone bumped you, did you feel like you had the wherewithal to hold them off? And the answer pretty much was no.
Yeah, and that was clear in his finishing. You could see it when he had a body on him. You know, the ball was caroming off the backboard. He was getting blocked. He would try to, like, go up strong and just get stripped down low because he felt like he really had to gather himself. It was quite obvious that that was an issue for him.
So he feels better in that regard. Secondarily, I think he's beginning to understand the position better in how to roll to the basket, what the right footwork is. Some of it has to do with the amount of switching people are doing now. If you kind of start thinking about setting a pick, if they switch, stretch. You're going to roll in one way to make sure that the defender stays on your backside and you're open to the ball. If they're not switching, you could actually roll a little bit differently, and I think he's beginning to understand those things. And then maybe most importantly of all is who's throwing the passes to him. You know, last night there was a play where Shelvin Mack drives in the lane in his low kind of crouch, powerful dribble, and he gets in the lane, and they collapse on him, and Rudy's open, but there's defenders through him, and Shelvin just doesn't see it. And let me rephrase that. He either doesn't see it, he either doesn't feel comfortable making it if he saw it, or he's trying to not commit the turnover, and so he curls back out the other way. The exact same play happens with Boris Diaw, who's much taller, holds his space better, owns his space on the floor better, and Diaw gets that spot and lobs it up to Rudy for the dunk. Dante, I think, lobs that up to Rudy for the dunk. George Hill, I think, gets that to Rudy for the dunk. I think that you have better passers than you've ever had before rolling to Rudy, and I think you have veterans. There was a moment in training camp in which George Hill was talking to Rudy, and the conversation was about where if George Hill's coming to the basket on a search dribble or even on a drive, how, depending where Rudy stands, is going to impact where he catches the ball. Rudy has a tendency to go to the front of the rim, and George is saying, well, then my pass, if it's a bounce pass, doesn't have enough time to get up. Right now, it doesn't matter what happens. You're going to have to go down to get that. But if you can stay back a step or two and let me come, I get that bounce pass in there, it's going to come up to your hands, and now it's one consecutive motion into the rim, and I think you become a much better catcher. And so that sounds pretty, I don't know if that sounds second level or basic, depending on your point of view, but those are the things that are different than what we've had before.
Rodney Hood, another guy who I think is looking to improve this year, he has had that hand injury in camp. I take it that's not really considered serious at all.
I don't know. I mean, it's another caught in the jersey thing. He got caught in the jersey. It happened last year to him. It's kind of re-aggravated this year. He's going to have to learn, obviously, how to play with it. So I don't know how concerning it is. And he didn't look good, comfortable early after he was wearing a wrap on his fingers. And after three shots, he ran by and threw it out into the crowd to get rid of the scorer's table to get rid of it. Anytime you've got something on your shooting hand, I'm not gonna say I'm not concerned.
Okay, well, hopefully that's something that'll
right. But I mean, I'm not trying to let me make sure that's clear. I'm not trying to make it like a big deal. But do you agree with me? I mean, pitchers throwing arms.
Some players seem able to deal with that. Others, Kobe always had problems with his hands and was able to deal with it okay. Others, it can be more difficult. Probably most people it'd be more difficult. That's a concern. But assuming he is able to get healthy, then what do you see as the major improvements that are realistic for him this year?
I just think he's got it. A coach once said to me about this league, he says, you either got 50-50 players, you got 80-20 players, and if you get really lucky, you got 100-0 players. And what he meant by that was, when I write in my expected box score line of this player, if I got Kobe or I've got LeBron or I've got one of those guys in there, hey, you Steph Curry, you can write across every night. And frankly, that's why the Warriors are just going to be unbelievable, is with Klay Thompson and Steph Curry and Draymond Green and Kevin Durant, you probably can write a pretty good idea what that line's going to be, right? Steph, you're going to write down 24, 4 rebounds, 5 assists. You've got a pretty good idea that's going to be right. That's a 100-0 player. Then the next level player is the 80-20 player. He's the guy that 80% of the time you're going to be right. Well, you're going to win an awful lot with that player. But when you start getting the 50-50 players, and you need the 50-50 players to be able to perform for you to win, then you become a 500 team. And the Rodney Hood is still a 50-50 player. You can tell me that Rodney Hood last year averaged 14 points, 3 rebounds, and 3 assists, but my chances of getting 20 points and getting 7 points were about, actually, my chances, there were more chances I was getting 7 than 20 out of Rodney last year. And he wasn't giving me 14 on a nightly, night in and night out basis. And I think that's where Rodney's going to change with that experience of being a starter for a year, is that he's going to be a guy who gives you a much more consistent night in and night out performance. Last year, he had 18 games where he scored 9 or fewer, and he only had 15 games where he scored 20 or more. And so he's going to have, I just think it's going to all kind of shrink down, and that there'll be more consistency night in and night out. Now, one of the ways that's going to have to happen is for him to shoot more free throws. Last year he only had 14 games all season long where he took 5 or more free throws.
Yeah, I don't know how he's really going to improve that, though, to be honest, unless it's just kind of the BS, like pump fake kind of game, because he doesn't quite have the quickness to get all the way to the rim. I mean, maybe what it is they'll have more spacing this year. And so then he, with his sort of herky jerky game, he can get all the way to the rim, because I think, you know, he can operate in pick and roll, get the guy on his back, but then he's still so slow, which is not a bad thing. He changes speeds really well, but he's slow enough that the help is always going to get there and deter him from really getting all the way to the basket. Maybe more spacing will help with that. But, you know, I don't see him as an explosive guy to get to the basket, go hard with the big out of position and draw the foul. So that may always end up being a weakness of his game.
I think I would agree with you almost entirely in what you said, but I think there's a way that he can play the game. If he took, you know, 2.5 free throws a game last year, can he get that to 4? You know, I think, it, you know, when you're an 83% free throw shooter, if you can get yourself to another 1 or 2 free throw attempts a game, I don't think he'll ever be 7 or 8, right? But I, that's a big deal if he can go get himself to the line 2 more times a game. And I understand where you, he's going to have to alter his game a little bit. We haven't seen anything in training camp yet that makes you believe he's going to do that. But for a shooting guard last year, he went to the free throw line 7% of his possessions used. That's pretty low.
Yeah.
And he's really, for him to be as high, for him to be an above average player, I think he's going to have to go to the line more than that. And that's exactly where he's been both of his first 2 years in the league. You know, if you kind of look at shooting guards around the league, that number's, that's a pretty low number for a shooting guard to be, you know, that low in percentage of possessions used to go to the free throw line.
Yeah, Hood still managed to be efficient because he takes 46% of his shots from downtown, which is helpful. I think that he is one of the hardest players in the league for me to peg his value. I mean, so he's going to be 24 this year. He has really nice ball handling skills. He can shoot it. You know, a good offensive player, maybe not a great one, but having a wing who can do the level of ball handling that he can is something that's rare, especially at his size, 6'8". So, and then defensively, he seems like he's like pretty decent, but not spectacular and not a ton of length. So I really struggle to say, all right, is he just kind of an average starting two guard, or is he more than that? Does he have the potential to be more than that? I'm not really sure. And if they ever traded him, not that I think they're trying to do that, but I think if they're going to trade him, I would find it rather difficult to peg like what his value would be in return.
So I think what we just talked about is going to be the issue, right? So he goes to the free throw line right now the same rate as Andre Iguodala, CJ Miles, and Kent Bazemore.
Yeah.
He's got to be, with the ball handling skills you just talked about, it's got to be higher than that, right?
Yeah, no, I think that could well be the case.
And that's probably what dictates exactly what we're talking about. You know, if he can get himself up into, with the ability to shoot as many, he's got a great talent that he can get 3-point shots off. We don't talk about that enough as a skill, but that's a skill he has. He can get that 3-point shot off. So now, you know, how does he find a way to go to the free throw line a little bit more? Then I think he becomes that player, but I think that's why there's still a question on him. And I think you're right on that question. I don't think that he has fully established who he is, and that goes back to where the area where we disagreed. I'm not going to evaluate him until I see him as a second time full year starting shooting guard in the NBA, which is this year, and see what areas he's improved upon.
Yeah, it really is hard to shoot a lot of free throws when you only shoot 11% of your shots at the rim, though, which as he does. I mean, and he shoots 20% in that 3 to 9 foot range, and then 13% from 10 to 15. So when you consider all that, it shows that, you know, he's got that great floater game. He's pretty efficient on those shots compared to the league averages, but it is tough to pick up fouls there. So is that anybody else that you see as being way better on this team?
Well, Trey Lyles could just be really good.
Oh yeah, that's true. My problem is I think he's really bad on defense still and not great on the boards either. I think offensively he could be quite a weapon.
His rebounding numbers are not terrible. So it's got to be second level looking at that to try to figure out what he is. You know, is he not getting contested rebounds? Is he only getting uncontested rebounds? I think there's got to be some level there. But he scores as easily as a 20-year-old as I've ever seen in this league.
Yeah, I love what his jump shot has become. I mean, and in summer league, when he's putting up 30-point games, I mean, the versatility to actually shoot jump shots off the dribble at his 6'10 size, to do some pick and pops, to catch the ball when his feet aren't quite set and take those shots, I think it's very impressive considering he was, what, like 5 of 37 on threes at Kentucky or whatever. So the fact that he's been able to improve that much that quickly is rather impressive. And, you know, it'll be really interesting to me to see whether he or Boris is going to get more time this year. What's your inclination?
I think he gets much more time than Boris, as much out of preservation for Boris's body than Trey Lyle. But I think Trey Lyle's going to be really good this year. I mean, I think he's really good. So I If Trey Lyles plays some defense and rebounds, two things you talked about, it's going to be awfully hard to keep him off the floor. Now, how you're allocating the 96 big man minutes gets interesting, right? Because if Trey Lyles is suddenly getting 25 and Favors and Gobert are each playing 32, well, there aren't a lot left.
Yeah, I don't see Trey playing 25. That seems like a ton. Maybe you might know better than I do, but I would be sorry. And they also want to go small, right?
I respect your thoughts on this. Yeah. Why do you think 25 is so many?
Just because he's not going to be good enough defensively. And that this is a team that has so many good defensive players, and they have plenty of other people on this team who can score already. And, you know, if Boris is out, yeah, I think he could play more. I mean, I think they're going to want to get minutes with Hayward at the four this year, too, or Joe Johnson at the four. I mean, and as good as Lyles is.
Yeah. So allocate, let's say Favors and Gobert both play and average 32 minutes. There's another 32 minutes to be allocated.
Yeah, so I think you're probably 14 to 16 or something for Trey, and then the rest is Boris. And you've also got playing at the four. Maybe Ingles will get in there a little bit. Maybe it'll be
so that's Hayward. You realize that's less than last year.
They got a lot better players than last year. He had to play last year. Now, if they're because of the injuries, he started like however many games he started 30, last year.
33 yeah. last year.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think he's really good. So I think he's going to be hard to keep off the floor.
I agree with you. Offensively, I totally agree with you. I just
he
think he's
really,
just,
really score. I think he's Ryan Anderson.
Yeah. I mean, I just got to see it from him defensively. That's what it is. And I think just the general nature of how coaches are, especially on a good team like this, if you're screwing up defensively and they have other guys who can score, it's going to be hard to play him when you have plenty of guys who aren't going to make those kind of mistakes.
So that's interesting. I always think coaches, whether talk defense and side offense, nothing gives coaches more anxiety than coming up the floor and not feeling they can score.
Yeah, but they're not going to have that problem this year, though. They got plenty of guys who can score. Now, if Hayward is going to be missing much more time, if Hood has trouble with his hand issue, if Burks can't come back anytime soon, then yeah, maybe you just need more scoring and you have to get him on the floor. But I think they have superior offensive options who won't screw up defense.
Interesting.
All right. So, but I mean, I do think he can get a lot better. And defense. I mean, am I wrong about his defense, or is it something that he really does still need to improve on?
I think he's worked very hard at it, and I think he. I mean, I think his lateral quickness is a little bit of a question, but I think he's really, really smart. So I think he's better defensively with anticipation necessarily than a lot of people think he is. I'm going to go back to this. He fits into that category. It's second time he's doing something. And I just think everyone's a lot better the second time they do it. I think that's been consistent on how I've seen the game for a long time. So I think he'll be better defensively because he's experienced everything once before. His rebounding in the preseason has been adequate, but I don't put a lot of weight into that. I think Trey Lyles is going to play a lot. I think he's really good. I mean, I think Trey Lyles is really good. Like, I think he's going to score 18 points a game in this league the day he plays 30 minutes.
Wow, that would be impressive. Anyone you are worried about a little bit as maybe regressing from last year?
So my initial answer is no, so that makes me feel like the biggest homer on the planet, and so I have to come
up. Well, I think
Joe
Johnson and Boris Diaw, you would have to say, just due to
the right, age. And so we talked about that, and I guess you said from last year.
Yeah.
So I think there's a real question on what player Alec Burks is going to be when he comes back. I just, who is he? And does he have to alter his game? Can he still drive to the basket? Frankly, his percentage finishing around the basket wasn't good enough to maybe make all those drives worth it, particularly with the injury risk. So, let's figure out what he's done. And then
how's his defense at this point in his career?
I don't think it's great. Off the ball, Ron Boone, my analyst, always talks about how he has a tendency to stand up. And so yeah.
Andrew Wiggins disease.
And then when the other guy catches the ball, he makes one move and Alec has to make two to catch up, but he's so athletically gifted that he often is able to. Alec's matured a great deal. His want to is great. He's just completely dedicated to it, but I just think he's at a evolutionary point in his game. And yet he's only 25 years old still. So I think there's just a great question of where he goes. Otherwise, regression, I don't know if some of Shelvin Mack's shooting was that he had with the Jazz. I don't know where he finished, but for a while it was so much higher than his career average. You might believe that that's not sustainable. Obviously, you mentioned the age of Joe Johnson and Boris Diaw, but otherwise,
Hill at 30 maybe could take a little bit of a step back, but he's looked good so far. I'm not too worried about him.
I thought Hill just got Monte Ellis last year.
Oh, yeah. No, we've talked ad nauseum about
Hill just got destroyed by Monte Ellis last year. So, the only one I look at is Shelvin Mack with the Jazz last year. Effective field goal percentage was 50%, and his career effective field goal percentage is 47.6. So, that seems to me that in all likelihood it regresses. But on the other end, this is a guy who played with more freedom. He's 25 years old. He played more minutes, and so he had more rhythm on the floor. Maybe that's exactly who he is, and someone finally tapped into it.
Yeah, I think I don't expect him to regress. In fact, unless the finger bothers him, but I would expect with way more weapons this year that Gordon Hayward's going to shoot better than 35% on threes.
What was the nylon calculus? They did a study a few years ago of how many threes it is until your numbers stay about the exact same.
750, I think.
And so at 750, Gordon finished, Gordon finished his fourth year right at 750. Maybe I'm off by it.
Yeah. He's going to be taking different shots, though. He's going to actually get some spot-up looks this year, which he really was not able to get much of as just like the only guy who could create, especially, you mentioned the point guards that he played next to. There's nobody else who's penetrating. He had to be split up from Hood a lot because they just needed Hood to be on the second unit when he was out. So I think he's just going to get a lot more spot-up looks and when he's taking easier shots. I think he was not going to be any better quality of a shooter, but he'll just get easier shots. That's my thinking.
Maybe. Yes. Logic, completely perfect. Let me ask it this way, though. If you're another team, do you leave him or do you leave somebody else? He's still the guy I'm not leaving under any circumstance if I'm another team.
Yeah, maybe so. I guess that'll just have to open things up for others then. And also, I think Gobert being more of a threat this year.
Well, that's the one that changes everything, right?
Yeah.
If Rudy can really go put pressure on the rim, then all of these guys end up suddenly having just a totally different world, because as much as we talk about spacing out, spacing in is equally as important. To your point, though, by the way, last year, Gordon Hayward, three-point shooting with a defender between 2 to 4 feet was 32%, 4 to 6 feet was 31%, and 6 feet or more was 40%. He did of his five threes a game, 40% of them were wide open threes, which he hit at 40% of the time. But I don't know that he gets more than 40% of his threes as open looks.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see whether that's the case or not this year. All right, we started talking about it a little bit, but what are some of the, and I think we probably talked about the front court enough, but maybe in the back court, what are some of the playing time issues that Coach Snyder is going to have to sort out this year?
Well, let's assume everyone's healthy.
Right.
For this discussion, the first decision that probably has to be made, if everybody were healthy, is Shelvin Mack or Dante Exum getting the backup point guard minutes?
That seems pretty clear. It should be Exum to me. Do you agree?
No.
How come?
Because I don't think I'm not entirely sure it's clear. I think it will be Dante, but I'm not entirely sure that Shelvin Mack hasn't played just as well as Dante in the preseason, and that with his experience of last year, that at times he might not be better than
Dante. I think the only advantage that he brings, and I haven't watched every single one of your games in the preseason, so maybe Mack is doing more than I expect, but he's kind of a known quantity to me, is just not screwing up, not turning it over on offense. I think they're probably about the same as like spot up shooters at this point. Maybe Mack can get his shot off a little bit more, and Dante I think is probably at least more dynamic on defense. Maybe he doesn't execute quite as well, but has some of the best defensive potential of any guard in the league. And then Dante is a better passer, and of course there's the aspect that they need to develop and they need to figure out what they have in Dante even too, because George Hill is going to be a free agent, so will Mack for that matter, and you got to figure out whether you're fine rolling into the next year with Dante as your point guard. So I think all of those factors to me would indicate that he's got to play Mack.
And I would agree with you on all of those, and I think that's the reasoning. I just don't think it's as clear necessarily as you stated it. So that's the first decision. Then once you've decided that, you're probably playing with the four guys that are Hill, Exum, Hood, and Burks as your front court. Then are you
Exum versus Burks is another interesting question.
I think Joe Ingles versus Alec Burks gets to be very interesting. Alec Burks, I could make a discussion on. I think he's a better player than Joe Ingles, but now you're asking me on whether or not who you're putting on the floor, and I start to think about Joe Ingles' strengths, which are spot up 3-point shooting, passing, initiating an offense, playing with teammates. Defensively, he's probably not great. And I think of Alec's strengths. A lot of Alec's strengths are built on playing with a lesser team and creating offense points himself, maybe you don't need that on the floor. Flip side of that is Alec Burks has never played on a stretch floor in his life. His stretch fours he's played with have been Enes Kanter, Paul Millsap when he wasn't a stretch four, Al Jefferson, and Derek Favors, and Trevor Booker, right? Those are the guys. So never has Alec Burks been on a floor where suddenly Boris Diaw is up top with another big and the floor is wide open and Alec Burks can drive and get to the rack. And maybe he's going to turn out to be a really, you know, powerful driving force in an offense of that sort. So I think that one's interesting. And then it just has to do with, you know, again, if you're playing 32, Hood's playing 32, Hill's playing 32, Hayward's playing 32, how are you filling in that combination of 54 minutes in those three spots? Is it as simple as just Dante's getting 16, Alex getting 16, and Joe Johnson's getting 16? Or are you playing around with it? Are you sliding Hayward ever to the four? Are you playing Hill and Exum together? What are all, there's just so many combinations. And frankly, the way this league is with injuries, I'm not sure that we'll have enough days where you ever have all 10 players healthy to know exactly what you would and wouldn't do.
Yeah, Burks, it's really interesting to me because I think he would really help on a lot of teams if healthy, teams that just don't have anybody who can get to the basket and make a play, like a Detroit or an Orlando, just some teams that just need somebody who can actually break the paint. I think he'd be great on Brooklyn too. You know, that's another one. But the question of, all right, if you're going to trade him, what's a decent value? I mean, I think he even could benefit from a change of scenery as well, just because the Jazz are one of the few teams in the league that are actually overloaded with wings. Of course, they don't really have much in the way of needs either. And they also have a ton of draft picks already. So, I mean, this is such a rich franchise at this moment in terms of resources. But I mean, what kind of a pick would you be willing to trade Burks for? I mean, I think if they could just get any first rounder, maybe they would do it at this point. But then I'm not sure if there's a team that would be willing to give that up. So a lot of questions there. But I mean, it does seem to make sense.
On the other end, he makes, you know, he's locked in for $10 million a year for each of the next 3 years. And the dude just comes off the bench and drops an easy 14 every night.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm not sure I'm trading him for anything.
Well, sometimes he doesn't come off the bench because he's hurt, which is kind
right.
of a problem.
Well, that's obviously the issue. Yeah. He's only played 58 games in the last 2 years. Here's the one about him that I think is most interesting. He's a really good shooter.
And yeah, he's kind of got that weird, like, knock-kneed motion, and it doesn't look smooth, but it goes in.
And I don't think he knows it yet, right? I think his whole career has been this driving phenomena that toward the hoop with this reckless abandonment and been able to finish, and now all of a sudden it's led him to significant injuries the last 2 years, and so all of a sudden he's going to have to adjust. But, you know, you dig into some of his shooting numbers, when he's open, it's going down. And so I think his instinct when he catches the ball is to put it on the deck and go to work. This is a 41% catch and shoot 3-point shooter last year, and I think it was higher the year before. And then when you start to look at the open 3-point shooting numbers, they're brilliant. I mean, I think he was 46% on open threes last year. So there's a level where he, I think, has to go through an evolution in his mind of who he is as a player, where he's now sitting on the wing and thinking to himself, all right, if I get a look right here, I'm banging down the three, where I think for the last years of his career and throughout college, he's been sitting on the wing looking for the gap so that he can drive to the basket and finish at the rim. And he's really could become a very, very good catch and shoot player. And the minute he becomes a very good catch and shoot player, then the whole world opens up for him.
Yeah. If he were just a little bit better at executing defensively, I would feel really good about him still. It's just, and obviously the injuries too are another issue. Let's talk about the key strengths that you see of this team. I think there are a lot of them that could be enumerated.
I think number one is that they should be able to hopefully be elite defensively with Rudy Gobert and Derek Favors, with George Hill and Grant Hill, with the length of Gordon Hayward, who I think is a above average wing defender. I think they could be, you know, incredible defensively. The trick, I think, is for the first time ever they have lineups they can put on the floor offensively. And so how are they going to be able to maintain both that defensive identity as well as playing at times with a versatility and a spread floor that gives them the offensive prowess they want? And will they lose that defensive element while they're doing, you know, while they're working on the offensive side of things? So I think that's going to be a question. So the two strengths, I think, are their ability to build just a defensive juggernaut. And then number two, I think, is the versatility of the lineups that we've been talking about and how many different iterations that they can put out on the floor. I do think that there's going to be an identity crisis in the midst of it as the season for a little while with this season that Quinn Snyder is going to have to navigate. I don't have any doubts that he can do it, but I think think that will be an interesting aspect of this year, is how he does navigate when to be the offensive team and when to be, you know, maybe more of a defensive minded team.
Yeah, but I think they do have the versatility and they do have more two-way players than in the past. And I know you hate creating expectations as much as like a campaign manager in politics, but I would be very disappointed if they're not a top five defense this year. And they just have good defenses.
Here's why I'm pausing, just to let you know why I'm pausing. I have vowed in my career to not be Dick Vitale. And what I mean by that is,
this guy's the best. This guy's the best without actually thinking about everybody else.
Right. And while I love Dick Vitale, but you know, he puts 83 teams into the tournament every year, right? Like, you listen to him and he's all, I can't believe that this team's not in the playoff or in the tournament. Well, okay, but right, but you gotta give me the team that's not gonna be.
I'll give you some other candidates here.
Who are the five? So Boston's a top five defensive team. San Antonio's a top five defensive team.
I don't know
about
San Antonio actually this year with
interesting. So I can add you to the Rob Mahoney, David Locke, Zach Lowe, Nate Duncan, just not quite sure about San Antonio group.
No, I think they're going to win 59 games. I just don't think necessarily they'll be I don't think they have the same upside that they did with David Lee and Pau Gasol are going to be playing. Aldridge is was okay last year in a better culture, but now as the best defensive big man, he's going to be miscast. So I think that could be an issue for them. Kawhi Leonard might need to score a little more, so maybe he'll take a little bit of a step back. Those sorts of things. I think they're not going to be any worse than seventh, but I don't think they are not like a candidate for the number one tier to me. I would say Boston.
Thought about this until right now, but so if I had to create my five best defensive teams, I'm putting in Boston.
Yeah. How about Atlanta? Maybe.
I'm keeping Atlanta. I think Dwight Howard's still good. I think we kind of. I'm putting San Antonio in. I'm putting Golden State in.
Yeah, I'm not certain about them just due to the effort. I think they probably, if everybody really tries to lock down, they're probably the best, I think. But I don't know about just during the regular season.
And so now my fifth is either Charlotte, Miami, or Utah. I'm not putting the Clippers in, and I'm making a mistake here by not doing this, but I'll tell you why I'm not putting the Clippers in. Their bench is so slow, I can't imagine they're going to be able to stop anyone.
Yeah, DJ Foster and I talked about that last week, actually, that their bench could be pretty atrocious defensively.
So I'm not sure that
What about Orlando?
I love Frank Vogel. I mean, I took Indiana out just because Vogel's not the coach anymore, and Nate McMillan has been one of the least good defensive coaches in NBA history.
And they got a lot of bad defense.
Well, and I might put Charlotte in instead of Indiana just because Al Jefferson went from Charlotte to Indiana. I'm not willing to go where you just went, that if the Jazz are not a top five defensive team, it's a disappointment. If the Jazz defensive rating is higher than 101, depending where the league is, let's say the league, what was the median last year in the league was about 103?
103 and a half or something.
So if the Jazz are 101.5 or better, I might be a little disappointed in that. How's that? Like, I think they should be, you know, it should be a signature to them. That should be an aspect that makes them, a really good team. But I'm not sure that just doing that right there, I feel comfortable saying, hey, these guys have got to be a top five defensive team.
I skipped over something. What do you think the crunch time lineup or lineups will be this year?
I have no idea. I think it's exciting, but I also think it's why this team has to win some games early, because I think they've got nine guys on the roster who think they should close games.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I mean, to me, it would just be the starting lineup. Favors and Gobert.
What about Joe? You're not closing with Joe Johnson on the floor?
Nah, he's not that good compared to Hood or Hayward. And
what about him at the four?
And so now you're going to take Rudy out, or you take Favors out? No way. Maybe they will do that. I hope they don't. I was about to say, actually, that the biggest thing that I have been critical of Quinn for, I love him as a coach, I think he's been done a wonderful job there, was taking Rudy off the floor last year for Trevor Booker at the end of game. And I thought that really bothered me. And even if there's no way to justify it, actually, in my opinion, but I'm sure they had a reason, because coaching staffs aren't dumb, but I certainly disagreed with it. So I mean, I am just a believer that those two guys are just so good defensively that you just gotta roll with them.
Okay, I like Joe Johnson on the floor late in games.
But he can't stop anybody, though. That's the problem. Like, to me, late game, a big part of late game is not having any weaknesses on either end. That, because you know teams are going to go after it and exploit it. And Joe is someone who I think can be exploited defensively and help defense if he's playing the four. So that's, I mean, I think he's just better kind of as a bench.
But when another team goes small, do I have Derek Favors? I'm all right with Derek Favors getting switched on a 1-4 pick and roll late?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think he's one of the best in the league at that. I mean, unless you... Even even if you're going against Steph Curry, I would actually, if you had to say, all right, Derek Favors is going to defend against a point guard in isolation or Joe Johnson is going to, I would much rather have it be Favors.
Worthwhile point.
I mean, any other variables you see in like in the crunch timeline? I mean, do you think that Quinn is going, I mean, aside from my opinion, which is maybe a little too strongly stated, I mean, do you think that Quinn will go with Joe at the four or any other modifications?
I think there's going to be times when Quinn really wants to spread the floor and get space offensively late in game. But the fact of the matter is that the Jazz lost games last year because they were bad defensively late in game. They were the 29th or 30th in the league in defensive rebounding. And they were a poor, poor defensive rebounding team late in games. And that cost them games.
Yeah. I mean, I remember you talking about that quite a bit on your show. I mean, do you think that's an aberration? I mean, this is a great rebounding team overall, usually if you have Favors and Gobert in there, at least I'm pretty sure that's correct. So is that an aberration or is that something you expect to trickle into this year?
I'm going to hope it's an aberration, but I do think that when you're that dramatically different late in games than you were in the rest of the game, that there's something going on, there's some value to it. And so the secondary aspect of that would be, you know, that John Schumann just pointed out on One Team, One Stat, that the Jazz were really poor defensively against the top 10 offenses in the league last year, which maybe most people were, but it was startling how different they were. And so I think there's some level here where there's probably some defensive adjustments. I know Quinn watched every single minute of these, and they also charted every single late game rebound to see what was going on. So I think there's some level where you will see the Jazz improve in this area with some adjustments. I just don't know what those adjustments are.
This is a good way to transition actually into what some of the weaknesses are. I mean, if you're an opposing coach, what are you going after on this Jazz team?
Offensively, I'm opposing coach going at the Jazz. I think I'm trying to spread the floor and make Favors defend at 24 feet. I mean, I think we saw in the preseason when Mo Harkless came out to open up the second half of the first preseason game and hits back-to-back threes that, you know, Derek, for his career, has spent most of his life protecting the rim, and it's not a natural thing for him to come out. So yeah. I think that's what I'm trying to get done in that regard.
Well, that's a big question for me because pretty much anyone who can shoot threes cannot handle Derek in the post at all. And what we've seen, this is one of the big strategic questions for me and why I think Gobert's improvement is so big, because what teams were doing was just putting their center on Derek to stop his post-ups, because he's just any power forward and especially a Harkless size like combo forward, Derek's just going to like put them in the goal and shoot like a 2-foot hook shot and score. So they would put their power forward on Rudy, and especially if that's going to be, you know, sort of a combo forward type, whether Rudy could hold up enough offensively in those kind of alignments. And I think Derek is pretty good for most like traditional power forwards in terms of defending the perimeter, but I think, you know, he does have those help instincts. So the question of whether Derek can beat up the other team enough, Zach Randolph style, to make up for the fact that the other team's going small against them, that's a big question.
And then you've got to have enough space on the floor so that he can go down there. And if Gobert's on the floor also, that's difficult. Secondarily, you've got to have good entry passes, which is an untalked about skill in this league that most players don't have because most players haven't played with anyone in the post in their career.
Yeah. So that would be one thing, and just, you know, trying to take advantage by going small, and then, you know, Rudy's lack of offense. I mean, Rudy's even shown like a few little post moves, and he's tried to get some deep position, I thought. I mean, that's it. That's the underrated way to take advantage of that too. It's not like, all right, we're going to throw it to you 15 feet and you back down. We're just going to duck in right at the rim. We'll just throw it to you, and they'll have to follow you. You know, I think that's an underrated way, but again, that requires
I think Rudy's going to be an offensive threat at the rim all year long, and I think there's going to be nights where teams don't game plan for it, and he's going to put up 20 points.
Yeah, and they got some great alley-oop throwers now, too. Anything else that you
by
see?
By the way, back to our closing lineups.
Yeah.
You got Boris Diaw on your team. You're not going to put him on the floor to close a game?
Yeah, again, I think it just the defensive weakness is a little bit of a turn for me with him. And it may be that they just need his passing. But the other thing, too, is that for Boris, while he is a great passer, it's so important for me that he actually be willing to take that three-pointer, because he actually will hit it at a pretty good rate, but he just always passes it up. And I think he just needs to be more willing to take that shot and create a little bit more space.
Agree with that. I think it's just going to be really interesting when they close games, who they close with. And I think lineup combinations, I think we're going to all have a hard time watching this team and not having try to make decisions out of lineup combinations without enough data. You know, lineup numbers never have enough data.
Sure.
And so we're going to be 20 games into a season making observations on this, probably incorrectly, because that's all the data we have. But it's going to be very interesting, because I don't think anything you said is inaccurate there. On the other other end, I would also say that, boy, if I got Boris Diaw on my team and I need to score late in games to win games, I'm going to have a hard time having him on the bench. Just watching him, he's remarkable what he does for every other player on the floor. And if I can stretch the floor with, I mean, who says I'm not running a Boris Diaw, Rudy Gobert pick and roll with George Hill, Gordon Hayward, and Rodney Hood spaced?
Yeah. I mean, Derek Favors and Rudy Gobert, to me, I understand the fit issues. Those guys are just too good to me to be on the bench, even if they are both traditional bigs. I think they're just, you know, even with Boris's great passing and Joe Johnson kind of veteranness, I still think that those guys are just, those are the future of your team. Those are great players. You know, also you're trying to get both those guys to extend theoretically as well. So unless Rudy gets done here already. So that's another reason they might not be too happy about not closing.
All valid points. All what make this team interesting. Also why I've said this whole time, I really think they got to win a lot early.
Yeah.
You know, this team's going to start the year 500 dope in the stretch without Gordon. They play a really tough opening 11 games, I think it is, largely because five of them in a row are on the East Coast road trip. I think of those opening games, only their first three are at home. I think they play eight of their first 11 on the road. They play good teams for a good deal of it. And I think they'll probably start the year 5-6. If they start at 4-7, that's actually fine. Even without, but then shortly thereafter, they better get rolling, because if they don't get rolling after that, then these issues that we're talking about become issues, because everyone's got a little thing they want, whether it's a free agent money or this or that, and they're all going to want to close games. That next stretch of games they play over about a month, they're expected to win, I think, about 15-17, and will be favored in that, and they're going to need to get it done. And that's where then this team comes together as a group, and nobody cares who finishes. They go 500 during that stretch, everyone's going to start to care who finishes.
All right, best case scenario for these guys, what do you think it is in terms of wins and maybe also even playoff?
I think the things that get interesting here is we've talked about a lot of different scenarios in this, and so I think there's a lot of different scenarios where this team has a best case. Okay, so if Joe Johnson and Boris Diaw still have enough game left, if Rodney Hood and Rudy Gobert take the jump I'm talking about, if Trey Lyles and Dante Exum both are, if Trey Lyles is the player I talked about who suddenly needs, you know, demands 25, 26 minutes a night, whatever, all of these different things, if one or two of them happen, right? If Gordon Hayward and Derek Favors just take the next step in their career, did I leave any out?
Yeah, I mean, there are a billion ways these guys can get better, and they have, both in terms of like individual players, ways that they can improve, and then also just they have so many stop gaps. If guys get injured, they have a ton of depth as well. I mean, that's one of the big reasons I really love these guys over the regular season, is because I think just the injuries are not going to kill them. I mean, unless it just gets to be an epidemic the way maybe it has in past years or for other teams. I think that on defense, best case scenario, they could be number one potentially. But what do you think is the best case scenario in terms of a league rating offense, guys? That's a harder question.
And I don't have my notes in front of me. What were we last year? Somewhere 16th. Between 14 and 17, I was going to say, is kind of where.
Yeah.
I think they could be, in best case scenario, here's my best case scenario for them offensively. They start to aggressively shoot the three. So what I mean by that is the league average last year was 28% of shots were threes. I think the number is going to go to probably 30 this next year. And the Jazz are taking 34 to 35% of their shots as threes. And they have a lot of good three-point shooters. And they're able to, you know, if they're getting off, so they've moved into the top 7 or 8 in the league in three-point shot attempts. They do that, they're a top 10 offensive team in the league. I don't know that their offense is going to allow them to do that, and they don't have individual breakdown players. They're going to force the defense to collapse a great deal, in turn be able to get them all these open looks I'm speaking of. So there might be something that's a real misnomer there, but I do, that's the vision where I think if they come together offensively, it's going to be exactly that. It's going to be that they really become a high-level three-point shooting team and one of the best in the NBA while they're doing that. And then I think they're a top 10 offensive team, and then they're a top 10 defensive team. And now you actually have the combination that allows you to suddenly compete for a championship. And now you're plus 50 wins, and there's your best case scenario.
Yeah, I think that one thing actually in terms of weaknesses, I think they can be a little bit vulnerable to switching, especially if you have Gobert and Favors in the game and it's later in the clock, because as you mentioned, there's nobody who absolutely can just blow by their man off the dribble. I mean, there's some solid ball handlers, pick and roll players, you know, who can pass, but even Hayward, you know, he's not going to blow by his guy. He can get himself a decent mid-ranger against a big, but you know, not maybe the most efficient shot. And then if you have Favors and Gobert on the floor, the switching can be more effective because now you can bring help more easily and pack the paint a little bit in those iso situations. So that's one something. And I do think there is a little bit of, all right, how much are Gobert and Favors going to play together? That's probably a better defensive lineup, maybe not as good of an offensive lineup. So you're kind of swinging the upside in both of those categories, depending on, are you going to go small more, skilled more, or are you going to play those two guys together for, you know, 20 minutes a night? Or
I think you're exactly right on what you just said right there. We saw it last night. Portland really plays a defensive style that forces you to go play 1v1 offensively, and the Jazz have a real problem when someone does that. When people just switch on the Jazz and make them just try to beat you one-on-one, that's where this team begins to get knocked out of what it wants to run, its flow system, and how it moves the ball, and is uncomfortable, and that's a problem for this team when that happens.
Yeah, I think their bench is going to just kill people, though, the Jazz bench, if everyone is healthy.
Did you see the piece that Andy Bailey did the other day? I thought that was...
That did not make it across my desk.
So Andy Bailey is an active Twitter guy in the Jazz world. He also writes for Today's Fast Break and I think a little Bleacher Nation, things like that. So he went and took the SI Top 100, the 538 ranking system, Basketball Insiders, and a few others, and he ranked how every team broke down by the top three players in the NBA. So obviously Golden State was number one, right? And the Jazz came out, I think, at fifth in the NBA when you looked at the top three. Then he looked at top five, and then he looked at top 10, and by the time you got to top 10, the Jazz were the number one team in the NBA. What's semi-relevant about this research, like, okay, well, why does this matter, is because of the fact that Larry Kahn, the great Larry Kahn, who you know well.
Larry Kuhn,
did some research many years back where he looked at ESPN's NBA rank and put the wins correlation. And once you got into the top five players, it was about an 82% win correlation between where ESPN's rank of your team was at the beginning of the season and to what your win correlation, which is pretty high. And it actually stayed that way for 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, between 81, 82, and 83%. And so I think there's some value to this kind of ranking system. ESPN, I don't think, clearly did their ESPN rank this year. And so there were a few less systems this year. But that jumped out to me a little bit. I thought that was eye-opening to your point that the Jazz depth is going to kill people. Well, that's pointing it out right there, that by the time you got to the top 10, the Jazz were the number one team in the league. And I actually, I was trying to find it for you here. Let's see if I can find it for you, and I'll give you what if you're interested, I can give you what the top five were. Utah, Golden State, Toronto, San Antonio, and Portland were the top five teams of 10 or more.
Yeah.
Golden State, Utah, Cleveland, San Antonio Clippers were the top five of five or more. Golden State, Clippers, Cleveland, San Antonio, Utah were the top five of three or more.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree. This is arguably the deepest team in the league. I would say, actually, going back to our original question, and again, this is going to create expectations, it is not impossible to me. We've said their upside on defense was number one. If they get to the 10th best offense, that's like a high 50s problem. You know, I mean, and again, I don't think that that's particularly likely. I would probably predict them, you know, 49, 50, 51 range, just as the more likely scenario. But I think that is it's possible. It's possible for these guys with all the depth they have. If they're the number one defense, they'd score pretty adequately. I mean, you know, for example, like the 2011 Bulls was the number one defense and the number 10 offense. They won 62. So like, it's possible. It's very unlikely, but I think it's possible. Let's talk about
it's a little bit of whether they can be the Atlanta Hawks of 2 years ago.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that they can be just much stouter on defense even than those Hawks were, and especially on the board too. That's
you know, 538 put out their numbers today, had them, I think, the fourth best record in the NBA.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's, I'm pretty close to agreeing with that. I mean, they could, this team could be the two seed, could be, very small chance, but could be. We're talking about best case, but now let's inject a little pessimism. What about worst case scenario?
I actually think the depth prevents them from a lot of worse. I'm much more likely to go here with the kind of optimism that
I think Hayward is still indispensable for them, though. If he's going to miss a lot of time, then they could be in a little trouble.
We're about to find out, aren't we?
Yeah. What's his timeline, by the way? Refresh my memory.
They haven't put one on it. I know that he just at some point here he's free to start working on things, and then it's just a question of what he can do and what he can't do and when he can play. I mean, it doesn't do you any good if you can't dribble to play, right?
Yeah.
There's a period, I don't know the exact time, but there's a period of time in which he goes through in which they say, okay, you can't do anything. Like right now, it's really incredible to watch. He's going through his entire workouts that he regularly does before every game at full speed with full intensity, all the footwork, all the other things for his 35, 40 minute workout that he puts into it before every game and at every practice before practice without the basketball. He says to me, yeah. he hasn't missed in like 5 days. So he literally has a coach out there with a ball pretending to throw him the pass. He's pretending to catch it. He then pretends to dribble, or if he's doing footwork to create space to, you know, step back or whatever it is, he does all the footwork and all the things, and then he goes through the shooting motion and then sprints to the next play.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you have a hand injury, like, there's not really much excuse for not being in shape. Like, you should be able to at least, like, do that. So it's good that he's doing that. But yeah, I mean, I think if he misses time, then maybe these guys fall back to being in the 20s, like very 20s in offense during that time period. I mean, I think, but the downside to me is probably maybe like 45 wins. What do you think of that?
I think I would take it a little bit lower. I mean, just in the sense that, but I do feel like if George Hill got them to 45 wins. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
And then anything that happens over that is kind of what gets the start. You start adding on. So Joe Johnson's good. Well, then we go to 47, right? Rodney Hood and Rudy Gobert both take jumps. You get yourself. So I think that gets them to 45. So then the question is, so you're now saying go, you know, they lose Hayward or someone for an extended period of time, then I think you drop into 40, 41, back into that area of where you were a year ago because of that.
So can I pin you against the wall here with a official prediction, or are we not doing that?
Yeah, you're not going to get me to do that. there's no positive value for me in any shape or form, and frankly, there's no positive value for any listener either, because there's nothing accurate to anything I'd be saying. So.
I disagree. I think it's, well, number one, it's fun. I mean, to me, just to go back.
And I find it completely unenjoyable.
Well, so here's why I think it's useful. And I mean, Brian Windhorst, of course, would agree with you. I think it's useful because setting expectations, I mean, even just simply team building is an exercise in determining expectations, in making a prediction. All right, this guy's going to be good. We think we can be good. Here's where we are in the success cycle, that therefore we should operate in this way. You know, all of those really are inherently predictions. And I think it's important to know what your predictions are so that you can then go back and say, all right, where did I get wrong, and try to improve your process as much as you can. That's why Danny and I did that show earlier in the summer of, all right, let's go back and look at our offseason grades and see where we messed up. And hopefully you get better at that in the future. And while prediction is like, all right, I'm going to write down this number, and then people are going to tweet at me because I was wrong, or I was too low, or I was too high, or you don't believe in the team, how could you, or whatever. Like, you know, I'm willing to deal with those slings and arrows because I think it's an interesting process, at least for me. Obviously, in your position, I understand why you might want to beg off of that. But I will say an even 50 wins. That's my Jazz prediction.
Well, I mean, I think I made my point that I think that the trade of George Hill got them to 45, and then we'll see what adds on top of that. And I can do all of the things that you just said with that basis.
Fair enough. All right. You got time for one more quick question here?
Sure.
Actually, I mean, you've been in Utah twice in your life. How long have you been the radio broadcaster now for the Jazz?
This is my eighth year, I think. Might be my ninth. I think it's my eighth year.
So if you had a Jazz or a Utah who really was getting into the team and got a gift certificate for Christmas for a Utah Jazz authentic jersey, what jersey would you advise them to buy?
So the first thing I would say, and I'm not just being a homer here, I know all these guys personally.
Wait, I might have asked you this before, actually, now that I
you have asked me this.
Let's skip it then. And I remember too, how about a classic Jazz jersey? Can we do that?
Let's do it. Do it again. Well, no, because that's Cedar's Dr. Malone. Do it again. We'll just answer it. Nobody will remember that I answered it once before. Just recap.
Well, only if you want to.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I can answer it because I have a good answer to it.
Yeah. When did I ask you that? I think it was when you came out in like March or something.
Right. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Let's hear it.
So the first thing I would say, because I do know all these guys personally, and I think that this is a really wonderful thing, is there's not a guy on the team who I would caution you to ever get their jersey because you're worried that you have to explain something to your child that they just did that day. So I think that's the first thing. And I think there's enough unique personalities to this team that you actually can kind of choose who you want based on the personality you want. With all of that said, I at this point would take a Rudy Gobert jersey because I just think there's a pizzazz to who he is.
Me too.
And and the aspect. And I think there's a real chance that one of the questions on the Locked On podcast previews that I've been asking all of the talent to do is, what player are we going to think about differently at the end of the year? And that's the guy that I think we could really think about very differently by the end of the year. There is a chance. There's a chance that Rudy Gobert is going to be one of the five best defensive players in the NBA while simultaneously putting up about 14 and 10 every night. And now you're into pretty rarefied air as a player. So, and Rudy's fun. There's a pizzazz to him. There's a little bit of an ass kicker to him.
I loved him when I first saw him at the 2012 Eurocamp. He was like one of my guys. I couldn't believe he lasted until 27. So yeah, I mean, he would be my pick too. He's one of my favorite guys in the league.
He's a neat combination of an underdog because he wears number 27 because that's where he was drafted, and at the same time, a superhuman skilled wonder athlete because he's got a 9'7" reach and a 7'9" wingspan, and he can
good
run
Twitter
like
account. He's got a good Twitter account.
Right. And he's personable. He's really bright. And so he's just, there's a lot to him. So it's actually, interestingly enough, my daughter chose that this year. She gets a jersey every year. She chose the new Pride short sleeve jersey with Rudy Gobert on the back. Gordon's going to be pissed.
All right. Would you like to take an hour to plug all 66 of the podcasts Locked On Podcast Network?
Find your favorite team, search Locked On, your favorite team, and add them and subscribe to them. And you can listen to Dunked On and them every single day and be completely complete in your NBA world.
All right, thanks so much for coming on. You can follow me on Twitter at @NateDuncanNBA. I actually have some things to plug. I've now submitted the Bulls, Bucks, and Cavaliers should be posting shortly on the ESPN Insider previews that they asked me to help out with a little bit. Should have the rest of the Central Division and the Wizards up probably in the next 3 or 4 days. So go ahead and check those out. If you just search Nate Duncan and preview, you'll probably find it. And I'm tweeting those links out as well. And that's about it. We will be back on Monday with the last two of the team previews, the Minnesota Timberwolves and the Miami Heat. And then it is time for the regular season. Talk to you all then.